Thank you again to everyone for agreeing to participate on this panel. What I'm going to do is just run through the slides. I'm not going to go through every single one of them, particularly since you didn't have any measures to review. We'll go over the measure evaluation criteria because you will be evaluating the maintenance measures based on that. But I want to leave adequate time for a robust discussion on where measure gaps remain, what research is needed, perhaps, to begin to develop measures for specific areas. So let me just run through the meeting goals and a few things here on the slide. If you can go to the next slide, number three, please, Hawa. So the NQF is a private, not-for-profit, voluntary consensus standard-setting organization. We have 400-plus member organizations, and they are convened through 8 stakeholder councils. The NQF is also structured with a board of directors. There's a consensus standards approval committee. This committee is the group that will actually look at your recommendations on these maintenance measures and determine whether or not the endorsement will continue or not. So they are a group that you will interact with at least via email. There's a National Priorities Partnership, which is a group that has convened over the last year and a half to 2 years looking at what are the national priorities that everyone should coalesce around for the coming years. And then we have a leadership network. The NQF's mission is to improve the quality of American healthcare by setting national priorities and goals, endorsing standards for measuring and public reporting, and promoting the attainment of national goals through education and outreach programs. The strategic goals, I think we can just skip these. That's part of the slides we sent to everyone. Okay, so if you could go back up one more, Hawa, please, to the number 8. Okay, so if we really look at where we want quality measurement to evolve toward, it's really driving towards higher performance, seeing a shift from the individual measures that look at one component within a condition, moving toward more composite measures that reflect comprehensive care for patients. Those are the types of things we'd like to see measures move toward. We'd love to see measures that address disparities across everything we do. And one key issue that we have continued to work on and probably will not necessarily come up today, but one that we constantly address is harmonization across sites and providers. Again, to ensure that there is the ability to compare and ensure there's alignment across settings. And then the last piece is to promote shared accountability and measurement, looking at, again, episodes of care. And where we really want to head here is more toward outcome measures, appropriateness measures, cost and resource use measures. Next slide, please. So, again, this just gets into a little bit more detail on the disparities component. We want to begin to assess quality by looking at race, ethnicity, and primary language and socioeconomic status, and feel that it should really be something that is underlying all measurement. So what you will see sometimes, we have a disparity-sensitive set that a group has looked at and determined that by reporting out these particular measures, there's a set looking at diabetes, cardiovascular care, as well as other conditions. Those would be informative to stratify and show us what it would look like across these different components and groups. Here you go. So one thing I just want to share with you to make sure you're familiar with this is some work that we have undertaken in the last couple of years, really looking at episodes of care with the goal of hopefully having both quality and cost or resource use measures in the future that would fit within these frameworks. So there was a group that came up with a comprehensive episode framework and then began looking at one condition, lower back pain, and then another one, which was, I believe, AMI, and trying to define throughout each of the critical components, the population at risk, those who are starting to receive treatment based on this, and moving into follow-up care and prevention, hoping that someday we will have measures that will fit within each of these and across these to begin to capture really what occurs within an episode. So we're not there yet, but it may be a useful way for us to think about your discussion on gaps in research looking within an episode of care if that's useful. So if we move down, let's go to the outcomes project, number 13. So this project specifically is funded by Health and Human Services and focuses on the top 20 Medicare conditions. Bone and joint has several of them in there, rheumatoid arthritis being one of them, osteoporosis being another. What we're finding is there's a wide variation in availability of existing measures. I think that's a great example for this group. You had none submitted. You are not the only ones. Eye care was another area that did not have any outcome measures submitted as well. But what the goal is to take a look at the NQF's current portfolio and really expand out on the outcomes component. We have multiple measures on process, but have not really fully fleshed out a true outcomes portfolio here. So if we look at the next slide, it shows there's three phases to this project. Phase one and phase two are being run concurrently. Phase one looks across cutting measures, also pulmonary, cardiovascular, and metabolic. And then phase two is where you all are participating, looking at rheumatoid and osteoarthritis, osteoporosis, and hip fracture. We also have panels on cancer, GI, biliary, infectious disease, and eye care. Then there's a phase three that is just starting and looking at mental health and child health, again, focused solely on outcomes. So if you move to the next slide. So project goals are really to identify and evaluate and endorse additional measures suitable for public reporting and quality improvements that address outcomes, both cross-cutting and in the 20 conditions, and then to identify gaps in the existing outcome measures and recommend where measure developers may head next to fill these gaps. So the NQF process, as you all are probably familiar with, is a formal consensus development process, really emphasizing multi-stakeholder membership and input. Everyone has an equal seat at the table. We look at looking across the continuum of care, and what we really ultimately do is formally endorse voluntary consensus standards. So on the next slide, I'm going to just show you a visual picture of where you fit within this whole project. So as you can see, we have the national priorities and program priorities, and then it becomes the project-specific topic, which here is outcomes. There is a steering committee. Dion actually sits on that steering committee. All chairs of the technical advisory panels participate on the steering committee, so she will be bringing your perspective to the table. Traditionally, if you had had measures, we would have been asking you to evaluate them and provide some input on any areas of concern or where you think additional information may be necessary on measures, where you agree that this truly would be a measure addressing an outcome of care. Again, unfortunately, we didn't have that for you today. But what will happen next is there's a steering committee meeting in April, the 20th and the 21st, and Dion will be at least taking what you discussed here today to them. So if we go to the next slide, we'll just talk a little bit of what you all do. I mentioned a little bit before, but we're really looking for you to suggest the gaps. So again, we're going to spend a good hour or so talking about that, and then I will take that information, we'll draft some summary of that, and then that will become a part of the actual report that is submitted for public comment at one point in the process. Just briefly, the NQF endorsement criteria on the next slide. Just, we had a measure evaluation criteria that was used for many years, but as with all things, it was time back in 2008 to take a look at that and see whether we needed to clarify, strengthen, or recommend changes. And the primary changes that occurred were making sure there was a stronger link to national priorities and higher level performance measures, again, emphasizing harmonization, emphasizing outcomes, and for process measures, ensuring there's a tighter link between the outcome and the process, which may be relevant for you to discuss when you look at the maintenance measures. So just very briefly, if you look at the old criteria versus the new criteria, we have some conditions for consideration. They really are, is the measure precisely specified? Have they filled out the form? Do we have an agreement to make sure that NQF can review them? That type of information. But the four most critical pieces are the importance criterion, the scientific acceptability, feasibility, and usability. So So really what we did was to, you can move down to the, do we have anything? I'll get into more detail on that in a minute. Let's go through the timeline. So where we are right now is having all the panels meet, and the main steering committee will meet April 20th and 21st. They may or may not have a discussion on your recommendations on GAAP. We may convene them by call or have them review your final recommendations, but they will be reviewing over 20 measures in person at that meeting specific to outcomes. We anticipate that everything will be going out for comment in June and then full through the rest of the consensus development process with everything hopefully approved by October. Let's skip through these. If we can go to 26, the evaluation process. Okay. Well, again, you don't have measures, so let's skip through. I'm sorry. Let's go to 28. So I think these are, we'll just quickly run through these slides. Again, it's something that you all will think about as you look at the measures up for maintenance. One of the first criterion, or the first one, is the importance to measure and report. So what we really are asking all the panels to look at is whether the measure focus is something that's important enough to really spend resources on. Is it relevant for public reporting? Does it address a high impact area or an N2F priority? Is there evidence to support the measure focus? And is there an opportunity for improvement? So a gap in care or variation across practices, hospitals, whatever you're measuring. This one is a must pass. So if you determine that a measure is not meeting the importance criterion, you do not need to evaluate it further. That's something that was felt to be absolutely critical. The next piece is, though, very quickly again, addressing scientific acceptability. So are there precise specifications? Can anyone out there take this information and be able to apply that measure within their own practice and then publicly report out, for example? Has there been adequate testing on reliability, validity, and discrimination? If you're looking at multiple data sources, have they demonstrated comparability across those data sources? Do they begin to look at identifying disparities? And I think for the measures you're going to look at for maintenance, it's not risk adjustment, but rather are there appropriate exclusions, if any, in the measures? We skip down to 32.
Heidi, can I just interrupt you for a brief moment? Related to the scientific acceptability, I think it's helpful for everyone to remember that from a reliability and validity standpoint, we are talking about reliability and validity of the measure at the provider or organizational level. And as we'll talk about shortly, this is potentially one of the issues that's getting in the way of measure submission, I think, is that measures are perhaps vetted at the patient level but not aggregated up and vetted as a provider organizational level measure. So I just wanted to plant that seed.
Sure, I think that's a very good point. And if anyone has questions or anything, please feel free to just stop me because I am going through these rather quickly. The third criteria is usability. So again, because we're looking at measures that would be appropriate both for public reporting and also informing quality improvement, is there evidence that the measure results are meaningful and understandable to the intended audiences? And is it useful for both purposes? And the last one is feasibility. And again, we're asking you to just evaluate the extent to which the required data are readily available. Can it be retrieved without undue burden? Again, ideally, if we can find a way to have measures that are available using electronic sources, that is ideal. Again, we're not quite there yet with everything, but that would be something else that we would ask you to evaluate. So those are the criteria. We can, again, refer back to them as needed as we have that discussion. But let's move down because I want to give us time to have an adequate conversation. So can we go back to the slide where, yes. So this is going back to the discussion you're about to have on identifying gaps. The Outcome Steering Committee met in the fall and began defining what they felt was perhaps categories for outcome measures. And so we can have a general discussion or you can have a specific discussion under each of these, whichever works best for you. But looking at the different areas of rheumatoid arthritis, osteoporosis, hip fracture, are there measures that you would recommend related to patient function and symptoms and quality of life? Are there intermediate clinical outcomes that we can have, perhaps measures developed on? Can we start looking at patient and or caregiver experience with care? They also put utilization as a proxy for outcomes here for consideration. Again, talking about morbidity, mortalities, complications, looking at safe and healthy living environments. So these are the categories they came up with as potential buckets, if you will, you can put the measures within. So I think, Deanne, I'll stop there and just see if there's questions, and then perhaps we can just open it up to a conversation on GAP.
That sounds good.
Okay.
So first, does anybody have any questions about anything Heidi just presented?
No.
Okay. So how about if we talk about the gaps, and I don't know that we need to go bullet by bullet, but if you all have either some knowledge or impressions about what the gaps may be and potentially what the barriers to measuring them might be, I think that would be helpful for us to consider. So I'll just open the virtual floor.
Where to start, right?
Well, just that. I mean, I'll follow up my thought about measurement at the provider level. You know, as I said, I'm a physical therapist, and so I would have thought that functional outcomes would have been something that would have been attractive to a number of folks to submit for. But the in your packet of materials, the one measure that is currently endorsed by NQF, which is the functional status change for patients with hip impairments, that's a time-limited endorsement precisely because it wasn't tested at the provider level. So my concern, at least from my vantage point as a physical therapist and outcomes that might be pertinent to us, is the lack of availability of measures that have been examined in that way, and how to encourage folks to do that work. So I don't know if others of you have similar observations or different observations about the experience.
Well, from the osteoporosis perspective, my two concerns or the gaps that I would identify would be, all these women that are getting bone density tests because they fall in a certain age group, and what is actually the result of that testing if it is leading to more women being treated. And so this might be considered like an intermediate or a first step outcome, but eventually we need the women to be treated and to see what happens, you know, to these women that are tested, if that improves or increases the number of women who receive prescriptions. And then on the other measure, where women who had a fracture, whether they were tested with bone density or treatment, actually how many are really actually receiving the treatment a year later, which is most of the case, very few. So to me, just dropping at just to know that a prescription was written, but did they really take it? That would be the only way to reduce another fracture, no, prevent another fracture.
This is Deb Sisma, and I'd like to piggyback on to the osteoporosis conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And the measures that we had already indicate for women 65 years and older, and the age seems to be too old, especially when we look at the measure relative to fractures. It's talking about women 67 years of age and older, where the guidelines are for both men and women over the age of 50. So I think we have a discrepancy there in age, but also we're not considering the men. And I would also agree whether there's follow-up of treatment, but has there been any secondary fractures that have occurred as well?
One thing that caught my attention as I was reading all the materials is that everything was referred to as a fracture, and it was not specified. I think maybe I found it once that we're talking about non-traumatic fractures. So people who have car accidents, older people who have car accidents, you know, are going to be included in the same bag unless we, or other kind of accidents, unless we specify that we're only addressing non-traumatic fractures. And there's specific codes for the circumstances of a fracture, so those can be weeded out.
Well, and so just to clarify on that particular point, I think for right now the issue I guess I would ask is there's the issue of measure maintenance, which is a subsequent conversation we're going to have, and so that your point is specific to that. But I guess I would also ask, are there gaps that you can think of or know of relative to people who fracture for other reasons? Or, you know, so trying to frame it in that kind of a...
What do you mean exactly? I'm not...
Well, so I guess I'm trying to make sure that we don't drift into measure maintenance conversations.
Okay.
But I think your point potentially has relevance to this question of gaps. So if we're thinking about the measures that currently exist, I'm really just asking back to you about... a point was made about gender, a point's been made about age, a point has been made about treatment follow-up, and I'm mm-hmm. asking you, is there a point in terms of gap that we can take away relative to fracture type?
You can talk about fracture type, but also I think there are multiple interventions, obviously surgical, that there's a tremendous gap in terms of looking at functional status, outcomes, morbidities, mortalities related to the surgical interventions, which we do not have any information about. I think part of the problem is that we don't have a lot of data in terms of reliability and validity to all of these tests, to all of these interventions, because most of them have not been done comparatively to a drug study where you're looking at a prospective randomized study to assess reliability, validity, any statistical significance. So I think there's a tremendous gap in terms of looking at these various interventions, which are very important, very costly to particularly the federal government, yet we really don't have any outcomes.
Okay. You know, and I'm also thinking... As you're talking, I'm realizing that some of the conversations that at least I've been a part of relative to the acute side of care, so whether it's surgical or medical, is this issue of attribution relative to outcomes. And it applies on the outpatient side as well, that one of the other challenges is recognizing to what extent the patient and or family contributes to the outcome and how to fairly and accurately measure the provider's contribution to the outcome. So there's another layer within that, I think, that becomes a challenge in terms of measure development in this area.
And I think that's particularly true in the elderly patient, where you're going to see a lot of the fractures that are basically non-traumatic.
Sure. Heidi, did you have other, you know, sort of questions that you're that we might think about relative to gaps? I mean, we've identified the potential lack of data just now. We've identified some gender and age-related potential discrepancies between what guidelines say and what at least currently existing measures are able to do. We've talked about attribution questions. We've talked about testing questions. Are there other thoughts that the staff have batted around about this?
Yeah, I think one area that is of particular interest and we haven't seen fleshed out very much and not seen many measures on is perhaps patient experience with care. Again, looking at functional status, is there anything else that we could perhaps look at? And I think the other area that's of interest that starts looking at, I think what you're talking about, is the appropriateness of care, looking at interventions, that type of thing. So if we could have a conversation perhaps on those few things, that would be helpful.
So appropriateness and what else?
So I would say functional status, patient experience, and perhaps appropriateness of care.
Okay.
And if there's anything else, I mean, but those are the, I know patient experience and functional status are of great interest, and maybe functional status with the ones that are there, we've covered at least a good start of it, the ones that are endorsed, but perhaps not.
Well, sorry, go ahead.
This is Deborah Palmer. I have a thought about a measurement that we're not maybe identifying, and that's just the decrease in height suggestive of a spinal osteoporosis. And I think we're missing a measurement of a large number of people in the population that are not being referred for testing, which perhaps just if you identified a discrepancy in their height over time, that may be an indication for a referral for a DEXA scan that we're missing.
Well, yeah, that is an indirect way of identifying someone at risk. But if the measure includes everybody over 65, then probably you're going to catch everybody who lost height, you know, in that net.
But I think there's a fair number that it's actually occurring younger. That because it's occurring younger and it's so easy to identify just with the discrepancy in height over time, it might be an easy way to identify appropriate people to be tested.
I don't share that in particular because it's a very crude way. But
okay.
And also you have to address the issue that not all offices have calibrated their stadiometers the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it becomes a you know, quality of the measure, I mean, of the height measurement, you know, issue.
Okay.
Yeah.
Getting back to the issue of functional status, I will say I guess the gap or one of the issues related to that is usability. It is, if you will, fairly burdensome to do functional status evaluations on patients on a routine basis, at least in a busy, active office practice. Because of the time commitment that whether it's a patient-centered functional status exam where the patients have to fill out the information or you're doing a manual functional assessment, it takes a lot of time. And I think that's one of the limitations and one of the difficulties if you use that as your outcome measure. Usability would be a real difficult task.
And my guess is that probably at least in practical terms, that would be something that we would offload. We, being physical therapists, would offload, if you will, because of course that's our bread and butter. So for us, it would be something that we would be expected to do, even if there weren't quality measures about it. But your point is well taken that if we're talking about who's thinking about measuring what and to whom is that measure applied, then you're right. I would find it surprising if I that any physician would have time to do it
right.
In any meaningful way.
Well, one thing that could be used is actually history of recent falls, and that is a significant risk factor for a hip fracture and other fractures too.
Sure.
So that is a very quick question that unless the patient has a cognitive problem, you know, they do recall, maybe they cannot pinpoint out the exact day. So that is actually a good way to assess a functional status, you know, and the deterioration to the point where they become at a higher risk for fall and fracture. So I think that might be, you know, one of the things that could be considered.
Well, I'm curious if any of you had anticipated seeing measures submitted from any particular group or any particular time of measure when this call went out. And if you thought that somebody might be submitting and you didn't see it happen, what you might think as to why that occurred?
Well, I spoke to my academy leadership about this because obviously hip arthritis, knee arthritis, joint replacement, it all fits with outcome measures.
Sure.
And their comment was that, number one, they just have not done outcome where they have not submitted outcome measures in the past. They've usually gone through PCPI.
Mm-hmm.
And second, they felt that because there weren't clinical guidelines and the question of reliability and validity was really the issue, and that's why they did not submit. But I think it's unfortunate because I think in this area, that this is one area where orthopedic surgery really, I think, would come into play.
Sure.
Yeah.
How about others of you on the panel? Did you have any expectation or at least, you know, anticipation that groups might be submitting?
I don't know why. There are many groups with many, at least osteoporosis guidelines, so I really don't know why not.
And in terms of patient experience of care, I know that's something that we have, again, in the physical therapy world, we've gotten experience with related to Medicare in the home health arena because of what CMS, the measure CMS has used. But I'm not sure that beyond that, that's something we've typically explored in a systematic way. I don't think there are people out there, groups out there, thinking of measures. We probably would be more inclined to look at the functional outcome measure development. That's really where most of the research and work has been done. I don't know if others of you have experience with those types of measures in your areas. Shall I take your silence as a no?
Yeah, I guess the only area you might look at would be rather than, let's say, activities of daily living, instrumental activities.
Sure.
Might be involved in patient experience. And there have been some studies for patients following hip fracture where they've looked at instrumental activities.
Okay.
But that's about it as far as I can recall.
Okay. Well, Heidi, what else can we do for you in relation to this conversation? What other things do we need to address that might help inform our work?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, really what we're hoping to have after this discussion is a succinct direction that could be used by measure developers and others, those people who develop guidelines as well, and where we think perhaps additional research would be needed or where we would like to see a measure develop next. And it sounds like this is, with many other areas, have extreme challenges and perhaps needs more research on both how do you measure and capture this information, not just at the patient level, but for reporting out by a clinician or a practice. So I think one of the questions I would have is if we had a call for measures on one of these topics, so rheumatoid arthritis or osteoporosis or hip fracture, where would you like to see a measure develop next? I mean, that's another way to look at it. Is there something that we haven't yet had endorsed or reviewed that specifically looks at an outcome, perhaps a complication, et cetera? And maybe you've discussed it already, but I thought I'd ask it in a different way.
Sure. Well, I mean, certainly I can share with the group that there is a measure that the QIO of Pennsylvania had developed related to measurement of gait velocity in patients, and I don't remember the exact specification of the measure, so I don't remember which patient groups it applies to, but my thought had been when we didn't get outcome measures in this area was that would be a measure that could be transformed from a process measure to an intermediate outcome because there are normative data out there about gait speed in elderly subjects and what that relates to. And so the issue would be prompting the QIO or somebody else to take on that development and testing process. But it's certainly something that physical therapists do routinely or should be doing routinely. And because there are normative data, there would be something to compare against or benchmark. So that would apply to hip fracture. I would think could apply to osteoporosis, although I don't know the data there. So that was my one thought early on.
You could apply it also to treatment of arthritis as well.
I would think so.
Medical versus surgical treatment of arthritis of the knee, for example, look at gait speed.
Mm-hmm.
For me, we have risk-adjusted mortality for hip fracture already listed, but we do not have morbidity or complications related to treatment of the hip fracture, which I think would be a useful measure. I was participating at an earlier TAP discussing complications related to surgery in the elderly patient, and they excluded hip fracture because it was considered trauma. But I think the same measurement and the same information could be used in the hip fracture patient. So I don't think you'd even need to redevelop the entire measure or come up with an entirely new measure. You could use the same measure and just apply it to hip fracture patients instead of patients undergoing general surgical procedures. It would be nice to have data on joint replacements in terms of complication rates, morbidity, functional status, 3, 6, 9, 12 months after surgery. That, to me, would be useful data.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would anticipate that there'd be that would fall that would address need from the standpoint of the volume of replacements that are done from year to year.
Absolutely.
So, and the other thing I would guess also is that that would push the boundaries a little. I mean, of course, the elderly being the target group, but you know, younger people are getting joint replacements, at least here in Richmond, from what I can tell. And so there may also be larger audiences for whom this is relevant.
Right. And if you start considering the baby boomer population, it's, mm-hmm. it's a tremendous, basically a high impact need.
Okay. How about the osteoporosis side of things? You know, you touched, there was a comment made earlier about fall history that I thought was really a great thought, but I don't know if you have other thoughts about measures. You've already identified measures related to whether or not people actually get the prescribed care.
What is it exactly that you, what do you mean by the prescribed care?
Well, you had referenced that the measures were going to do maintenance on, talk about whether or not a prescription was provided, and your comment, if I understood you correctly, was, you know, okay, so they got a prescription for a medication or they got something, but did they actually, were they able to follow through and what was the impact?
Yeah. Yeah. And as well, I mean, this could be branched into several aspects of what you consider treatment, because then you have all the education piece from the fall prevention to the exercise to the adequate calcium and vitamin D. So they not only have to fill the prescription and take it, but address all the other, you know, issues that will enhance the treatment and hopefully reduce the risk of a second fracture. So, you know, all that can come from the patient experience, if you want it, or patient education, if the patient was taught and if the patient understood what he or she was taught. So it encompasses more than just doing a bone density.
I guess to me, in terms of osteoporosis, are we doing too little too late? Should we really be looking at patients getting bone densities at age 40, or particularly women at age 40?
It is not really cost-effective to start testing women so early, although you will identify some with low bone densities. The risk of fracture at that age is so low. So from the cost-effective measure point of view, I don't think anybody would, you know, start scanning women before 50 or the time of menopause.
What about initiating treatment, though?
Well,
calcium, vitamin D in that population.
Well, that for sure. I think that, you know, children should be on enough calcium and vitamin D. So I think that is a matter of public education.
Right, but I'm not sure that that's being done, though.
Oh, no, certainly not.
Right.
Certainly not. But at the same time, how do you measure all that other than in a physician's office and documentation of what the patient reports? And then do we have the tools to collect all that data? I mean, the electronic records or something where it couldn't be just a headache to collect all that?
I mean, we're looking at patients getting, or one of the measures we're reviewing is the anti-inflammatories or pain medication for arthritis. It would be the same thing, the same measure, looking at calcium and vitamin D for women, you know, age 30 and above.
Yeah.
In reference to your comment about testing earlier, as early as age 40 with DEXA scans, perhaps just looking at the patient experience, whether or not their provider did the World Health Organization fracture survey screen, which may be a good way to weed out those who are under 55 that maybe need DEXA scan testing sooner than what's currently recommended.
Are you talking about the FRACS program?
Yes.
Well, I
yes.
think the FRACS is not applicable for young people. They just did it in such a way where the data they obtained was,
it is if they say there are some indications if they're not taking hormone replacement and they've had a hysterectomy or a strong family history, or there's several questions to screen out the younger population that would benefit from a DEXA scan.
But the program was designed actually for women over 50. It was not designed for to be used in young people. Because the data they used to create the algorithm was data from older people.
But as early as 50, right?
Yeah, at 50.
Okay. So measuring those that are just screened with that tool might provide some useful information. Maybe we're missing a lot of people were not screening at age 50.
So it sounds like to me what you're describing is really, what you're all describing is sort of layers of need depending on where we are in a particular area. So this conversation suggests to me that we need a better understanding of who under the age of 65 is even being identified or screened, or that we could get a better sense of that from 50 to 65 using this tool. And then from there, measures might be developed relative to the use of that tool, number one, which would be a process measure, but then the impact, some kinds of measures related to impact if, in fact, women and men between 50 and 65 are being screened, what's happening to them once they've been screened. And so different layers of need about information that we have relative to measure development in each of these areas. Is that an accurate
Thank
assessment?
Thank you. That's a very nice summary.
Okay. Well, and I wanted to return to a point, and I'm sorry I don't remember who made it earlier. This issue of lack of guidelines, I think maybe this came up related to the AAOS not submitting measures.
Right.
And I think that's another, or at least I need some guidance if this isn't an important issue, but to me that would seem to be another place in response to Heidi's question about where would we focus a call for measures, that the presence of guidelines that are well vetted and well reasonably well accepted anyway seems to be a key determinant. Is that on target, or should it be on target? I mean, is that where we should be, as opposed to calling for more data, calling for, you know, putting process measures in place that allow us to get more data to identify need? I don't know if I'm making any sense, but I didn't want to lose that thought.
It may be that some of these organizations have not adopted guidelines from other organizations. So, for example, has AAOS adopted the NOS guidelines for screening and treatment of osteoporosis? So, you know, that may be an example where there may not be established guidelines in one organization, but there is in another that is well established and based on scientific evidence.
So you've helped me clarify that that one aspect may be there simply are no guidelines on the in the area, and I think that's what was discussed earlier relative to surgical interventions.
Correct. Yes.
And the other, the next piece may be that there are guidelines, but they're not universally recognized or adopted by potential measure developers. And it may be that they're not even aware of them, although I doubt this particular example that was the case. But that there may be some need to help measure developers, potential measure developers, know what's there that might be relevant to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what else? I think the absence of guidelines is its own challenge. I'm not sure we can solve that for anybody.
Well, I guess the other question is how necessary is having established guidelines for developing an outcome measure? If you do not have an established guideline, does that really prohibit you from developing an outcome measure?
And Heidi, I'd be interested in your input here, because I know that's a question on the submission form, but as I recall, it's not a make or break item, correct?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, and it's something we have a two task force meeting in the, well, they've met over the last few months looking at the evaluation criteria in two specific pieces. One was specific to measure testing, and then the other one is specific to evidence. And they have really moved toward, I think, for an outcome measure, you may not need a guideline. It may be based on several randomized controlled trials, or it may be based on some other form of evidence. And I think that is something that we will see them continue to further flesh out, and I think it will be interesting to see where this heads. But I don't know that you necessarily do need fully fleshed out guidelines, and perhaps it's just some rigorous research.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would say that that's for the possibility of getting outcomes measures in areas where we don't have guidelines, that landing on the side of well-done research would be a more accessible way to get outcome measures submitted, because the guideline development process, as you know, if you're going to do it well, is pretty involved in its own right. And so the idea that AAOS or APTA or anybody else could pursue measure development as long as they have some good evidence to support their approach probably is more likely to be successful getting measures submitted, I would think.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Now, the one area I haven't heard much discussion on is rheumatoid arthritis, unless I've missed it, but that was the one area. And perhaps, there isn't anything, but I thought I'd ask.
And I don't know if the absence of some additional panel members is part of why you're hearing the gap in conversation.
Exactly, that's possible. Well, what we'll do is we'll circulate this around and ask people to contribute more. So,
okay.
If there isn't anything now, I'm sure we can add more later.
I mean, my own intuition is that even though they aren't designed, they don't reference RA specifically, the two maintenance measures about OA that we have potentially are also, applicable or could be, if the developers were so interested, could be morphed to be. From an outcome perspective, I agree with a comment made earlier. I mean, gait velocity, if that was ever to hit the ground. The hip impairments measure that is time-limited endorsed would apply to them already. I don't know if similar concerns exist about, but I would guess they would, about getting prescribed care. So, again, the follow-up comment that was made about the osteoporosis measures, whether process steps that were taken for the management of patients with RA were actually followed through and to what end. I would think all of those would be similarly relevant, but I'm not the content expert there per se.
Okay.
I think also the complications of medical management of RA, I think, would be interesting to look at because of all of the new medications that are being used that put patients at high risk of infection and other things, I think might be worthwhile looking at.
Great, thank you.
Okay, Heidi, you think we're ready to move on to the measure maintenance process?
I think maybe, yes.
Okay. So as we discussed at the start of the call, we have four measures that are currently endorsed by the NQF that are due for their maintenance review. And two of them were submitted by the NCQA, and we have a representative or representatives here available if we have questions, and then the other two were submitted by the PCPI, and we also have representation there. So I guess, let's see, we have them in order, osteoporosis testing in older women. You all got the extensive review material that the measure submitters are required to complete, so thank you to them for doing a thorough job there. Heidi, I'm sorry, I don't have it right in front of me. Who was asked to vet this measure a little bit ahead of time?
Sure. It was Susan Edgman and then also Sylvania Levis, who I think is still on the phone.
Yep, still here.
Great.
So, Sylvania, maybe you want to start and give us your assessment. Would that be all right?
Yeah, and I will need some of your help in going through this process.
Okay.
Which one are we doing first of the two?
We'll go ahead and do the osteoporosis testing in older women. And
okay.
The key is really to focus on the four criteria. So, you know, don't feel the obligation to go page by page by page and content area by content area in minute detail. It's really getting your impressions about, and of course everybody else can join in, the scientific acceptability, the measurement, scientific measurement piece, the importance, I'm sorry, the scientific acceptability, the feasibility, and the usability, and kind of your impressions based on your content expertise about the measure.
Well, considering the bias that one might have because this is the area that one works with, so I think this is an important measure because it identifies, it's the only way to identify people who have osteoporosis before the fracture. So if we're going to treat women, as Dr. Carpen said, ahead of time and earlier on, the only way to do it before the fracture is to have a bone density test and see who's at risk. So I think the measure is important. It is scientifically acceptable. And the feasibility, I think it's becoming an issue right now because there's no, the testing is not available at all facilities. And depending whether it's urban or rural, you might have, you know, greater access to this test or not. And the usability, I think it's fine too. I have an issue, as I said before, you know, it's what happens beyond the bone density testing, but this is the very good first step.
Okay. Other thoughts from the panel members or any questions for the measure steward?
I just had one question about the types of tests. Are they still as reliable, each type? Because they have DEXA scans, they have wrists that...
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. And there, let me go flip back on my pages where I marked this. There was some unusual, not widely used or accepted tests that I saw somewhere in the list, and now I cannot find. Even the CT, the densitometry done by computer tomography, it is actually very accurate, but it's not you know, it's not available in most places, so it becomes an issue. And also whether, you can start comparing information. And I would say that the DEXA is actually the main test that should be considered. And I'm still flipping through the pages and trying to find it. There was the heel, the finger, and those are, you know, interesting tools for someone's office, but actually you need the real thing to be able to get to the diagnosis. So that might be something that we might consider revising.
So this is Heidi. I think we have the measure developer on the phone if they want to provide some clarification. Maybe helpful.
Sure. This is Sue Milner with NCQA. This is a survey measure,
right.
and so the patient may not really know, you know, whether a DEXA test was done as opposed to another. So the survey question really tries to put the type of test really in layman's language in a way that will allow the patient to recall whether or not this will have been done. So I think that as we move forward and begin to develop measures for electronic medical records, really understanding more precisely the types of tests that are done will be something that will be more possible. But right now, in terms of understanding whether older women have actually had a test, one of the best ways we have of doing that is to simply ask them and to keep the language as simple and as broad as possible.
I guess my comment to that would be, do we want women to get tests that aren't valid and aren't reliable?
Tested on what? On that, you say? The thing is that if you're going to be asking the women, unfortunately, many will tell you that they have osteoporosis when actually what they have is osteoarthritis, you know, and so I don't know if asking the person is a good way to knowing whether this is done or not.
Well, and I was just curious, a public member made a group made a comment, it was actually the American College of Physicians, asking about the validity of self-report relative to whether or not somebody had a test. And I know the NCQA responded that there is some work going on in that area. I don't know if you have any preliminary information about that work that you might be able to share with us or give us some insight. Of course, this is an issue for a lot of outcome measures as well as self-report. So you're not alone in that quest.
I believe that the self, when we first developed this measure several years ago, did cognitive testing in a small group of women. I believe that we looked at that issue, and one of the things we found was that self-report was accurate enough in order to be a valid measure.
Okay, but then we go back to the point where, do we think that having a bone density test of the index finger is a good test to have? So if you count those women as women who had the appropriate test and the measure, they are okay, you know, in this measure, then we might be misleading, you know, everybody and supporting a test where there's no scientific, backup.
So if I could reframe that a little bit, is the concern that the measure specification is asking a question in a way that, because it says this test may have been done to the back hip, wrist, heel, or finger,
Yeah, here I found it, yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's the specific list of body parts, some of which may not be supported by the evidence as the best place to test.
Yeah, the heel and the finger are definitely not the best. And furthermore, I think maybe an orthopedic surgeon might coincide with this or not. The spine in women over the age of 60, 65 is actually very unreliable because there are a lot of confounders there, and they may actually look better than what they are.
Right, because of the arthritis and
exactly, calcifications of the aorta and et cetera, yeah. So if we're going to go, you know, into the detail of things, that's a reality.
So, Heidi, how would you like us to sort of, I mean, I know you're keeping track of our conversation, but this would be the kind of comment that would be forwarded to the steering committee for them to consider as part of the overall decision to continue to endorse the measure. Is that correct?
It's actually, this will go in a little bit different process. It will go straight to the CSAC.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, a little different.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I think the key question that this group needs to probably answer and put forward to the CSAC for consideration is whether the evidence still supports this patient survey measure as it's currently written, including, you know, index of the finger or the index finger or heel. And then I think we can ask the MCQA if it's one of those things that they are in the process of reconsidering, is that something that we can factor into the decision? But I think the question to you today is, does the evidence support this measure as it's currently written?
So it's really an all or none phenomenon then. We can't say it's a good measure with this modification. Is that correct?
Well, you could, and then we can give NCQA time to respond. That is another way to do it. You're right.
Okay.
I would go with that one then.
I would think it would be a good measure if the testing was limited to the DEXA scan. Would that be?
Yeah, I would go with that.
Well, so let me just clarify. I think, at least if I understood correctly, there were two issues on the table. One was the type of test that was performed, and the second was what body part was assessed.
Let's put it this way. There's not that many types. You have either an X-ray based or an ultrasound based.
Right.
Now, somewhere there, I wrote a radiogram or something. I have to go find that also. Technology that is totally out of. Here it is. In page 8, it's photodensitometry, radiogrammetry. I mean, this is totally outdated and not used anymore. And bone mineral content study. So how is that different from the DEXA, which is 3 bullets above? Some of this technology is not actually current.
Okay, so there's the technology piece, and then there's the issue that applies, I'm assuming, regardless of which body parts the evidence would say are most reliable indicators.
Right, and the heel and finger are definitely not.
And so understanding is, or your knowledge is, that there is evidence that has ruled them out as less reliable than the other places.
Yeah, what ends up happening is that people end up having the DEXA scan anyway, you know, and nobody gets treated based on those results.
Okay. So, I don't know if there are any other panel members who want to chime into the conversation. It sounds like we're agreed that the need for... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I agree with this, and this would be an area that if there were additional measures looked at, that we could look at screening for people younger than this. So that was part of our earlier discussion. But
sure.
Supporting this measure, but then perhaps adding another measure for screening, including height loss, a whole variety of things that are recommended in screening for osteoporosis.
Okay. So it sounds like we're agreed that the need is there, where there's no question about the need for the testing and therefore for the measure to see that it's being done. It sounds like the scientific acceptability from the standpoint of reliability and validity is there. The feasibility piece is the piece, or I'm not even entirely sure which category this conversation we're having about the specification for where the testing occurs and what type of test is used belongs, whether that's scientific acceptability or feasibility, but there seems to be a blend in there. And usability, I think we're agreed, is okay. Have I got that right?
Mm-hmm. Is there a way to measure this with physicians instead of patients?
This is Sue Milner. One of the issues that we've had with this does deal with scientific acceptability. And the guidelines that are out there, I mean, particularly the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force guidelines, recommend screening for women over age 65, and they talk about that as being highly cost-effective. But they don't really talk about periodicity. So part of the reason we have a survey-based measure is because if we move to a measure where we're actually looking at clinical data, administrative data, in this case, I think EHRs are, you know, somewhat of a different animal, but we're not there yet. You know, we don't know. We have to pick a time frame around, you know, which a person is in a plan or sees a healthcare provider or whatever. And because there's no periodicity associated with the guidelines on this measure, you know, understanding that becomes difficult. So that's part of the reason why we opted to do a survey-based measure which asks women whether or not they've ever been screened.
This is Heidi, too. NQF has one or two measures that actually look at screening from the practice or health plan or physician-clinician level. So you do actually have a complementary measure that looks at the other piece of it. Was it ordered and completed, the bone density?
But again, Heidi, you're really looking at cross-sectional data, right? So this is...
Right. I guess, Sue, I'm just answering the question that was raised about whether or not there was additional measure that looked at the other piece of it from the clinician side. That's all I was saying.
If it would be helpful to have the period component, guidelines recommend every 2 years. So the question could be done, could be asked if they've had a bone density within the previous 2 years, if they're over age 65.
Well, I would have to I'm not so sure that would be the case, because every 2 years is what Medicare covers. The test every 2 years. But a woman who at age 65 had a bone density that was very normal, and then she probably does not need another one for the rest of her life, maybe when, you know, or many years later. So failing to pass this you know, measure, if she's 67 and, or 68 and hasn't had one in the last 2 years, actually she didn't need one. So they, you know, this is a very difficult question, how to measure, you know, how often and how many who should have one.
Well, and this is Dion. I'm going to intervene here just because we have three more measures we need to get through before the call concludes. It sounds like what we've been able to do is identify several areas where either additional measures might be useful if we can come up with the right specifications, if the developers are willing to, you know, think about those specifications. But that the key concern related to this measure relates to the specification about where the test might have been performed, in other words, which body part, and whether or not the evidence continues to support that, and the technology that was used, recognizing that this is a survey measure. So we're not asking the patient, did you get a one type of test versus another, but a concern related to that. Is that an accurate assessment of where we are with this particular measure?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. If that's sufficient, I would like to ask us if we could move on to the next measure, unless there's any other comment that somebody feels they really need to make.
No.
Very good. Thank you. Okay. So the next measure was the osteoporosis management in women measure. And so, Sylvania, were you the also the person, or would you like to take a first crack at it?
Sure. Let me see here. This is whether they had there's a few points that I identified as another caller mentioned. Why is 67 for the treatment and 65 for the testing? I don't get it, why it's 67 and why we don't make it 65. That's one comment. The other comment is that you will find that there are many people in the osteoporosis arena who would actually take an issue with people having had a fracture and requiring that they have a bone density testing, in the sense that if they had a non-traumatic fracture, that is sufficient to diagnose osteoporosis and you know, trigger treatment. So maybe having a bone density test might be totally unnecessary at this time. So the other one was, again, the type of technology that is listed that is not appropriate in some of the instances. And last, the therapies that are listed here, there's calcium and vitamin D, which should be actually part of every osteoporosis treatment. It's not included. And zoledronic acid, brand name Reclast, is also not listed and is an approved medication. Injectable estrogens, I've never heard treatment for injectable estrogens for osteoporosis. I think that should go out. And estrogens themselves are good for bone health, so it could be an acceptable therapy if the patient is already there. The other thing is calcitonin as a treatment for someone who had a hip fracture might actually be not appropriate, as it has shown to decrease the risk of vertebral fractures but not of hip fractures. So if we're dealing with someone who had a hip fracture, that is inadequate treatment. And that's very briefly my comments.
I also had a question about the age, and I don't know if the NCQA would like to respond to that. I couldn't find it in the history. I tried to look around to see what the reference might be, but why 67 and not 65?
Right. This is Sue. So the reason for 67 is this measure has essentially a very long look-back period. And since this is a measure that deals with the Medicare population and kind of, you know, because of the long look-back period, which is essentially, you know, a span of about 2 years.
Sure.
Earned 67 day of the measurement year. So in other words, December 31st. And that way, in order to be counted in the measure, in the denominator of the measure, we're assuring that they were 65 at the beginning of, you know, the time frame period.
Thank you. So did other panel members have questions, or should we let Sue go ahead and address the ones that were, or the comments that Sylvania had already posed?
Oh, I would agree that, you know, the technology and the Medicaid and the therapeutics need to be updated.
Sue, do you want to respond to that commentary?
Yeah, and then I'd like their help in so that I can take some more detailed notes as to, you know, very specifically what you feel needs to be addressed in terms of the technology. I heard Sylvania say that she felt that a bone mineral density test for anyone who's had a fracture isn't, you know, necessarily necessary. But I would just point you to the fact that we're also counting whether or not the person's had a dispensed prescription to treat osteoporosis.
Is it and or is it an and?
Greater criterion, so it's the bone mineral density test itself. I don't know if that fully addresses Sylvania's.
So it's the measure is they had a bone mineral density test or a prescription.
Right. Both of those meet the numerator criteria.
Right. But testing someone is not enough. If they already had a fracture, I mean, they need the treatment. And a bone density test is nice, but you don't need it. So if someone passes this measure because they had the bone density test and did not have treatment, we're fooling ourselves that we did something good for these patients when actually they didn't receive what they actually needed, which is treatment. And the bone density test in this setting is a bonus.
Okay.
And actually, if I could just, this is Dion, if I could just get some clarification here, I think I might have missed a point along the way. So, Sylvania, in your introductory comments, you mentioned that if they've had a non-traumatic fracture, that was the test itself, if you will. Yes? That bone density.
Well, that is the diagnosis itself. So you don't need an X-ray test to diagnose something that you already know the patient has. You need to treat them, and that should be forces should be, you know, aiming to getting the patient on treatment.
Okay. So for non-traumatic fracture, I think that was, if I understood Sue's question properly, that was the clarification she was, that was the point she was seeking clarification on, that because the person has fractured, we know the diagnosis, so having the test is not adding value.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the question becomes, are they being treated? And this measure does capture treatment. It's an either-or to count for the measure, right, Sue? Did I get that right? In terms of assessment, it's test or prescription. It's not test and prescription, correct?
It's an or. The way I have it is or.
Okay.
Just a 15, that's correct. It's an or.
Thank you. So, Sue, what else can we help with in terms of clarification based on the comments that were made?
I think that you had some comments about the type of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps if you could just review those again, that might be helpful.
You're talking to me?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. There's a list of allowable therapies, and some I think should be removed and some should be added. And first and foremost, calcium and vitamin D should be added. There's another medication that is approved for the treatment of osteoporosis, zoledronic acid, or Reclast brand name, that should be counted. And injectable estrogens, I don't know who prescribes injectable estrogens, but I haven't heard of that. So I think that one should be removed.
Also calcium and vitamin D.
What?
Also add calcium and vitamin D.
Yeah, that's what I said. And
right.
Then,
I think one of the difficulties, though, is since those are over-the-counter medications, it's hard for us to capture those.
But weren't you asking, is this weren't you interviewing or women, or this you're going through pharmacy records? How is it?
Good question. The first measure that we talked about, the osteoporosis screening measure, is a survey
mm-hmm.
measure in our Medicare Health Outcomes Survey
mm-hmm.
measure. Is a measure that's based on administrative data. So this actually looks at ICD-9 codes, CPT codes, HCPCS codes, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Goes into the administrative data. And unfortunately, with calcium and vitamin D, those tend to be over-the-counter supplements.
Yeah. No, you will not be able to capture that unless you have electronic records or something like that.
Right. Not with any reasonable.
No, you won't. You won't be able. But still, I think there's a drug that should be added, zoledronic acid. I think we should remove injectable estrogens.
Okay, and then I heard you talk about reclass bromine or bronine.
Zoledronic acid is the drug name, and reclass is the brand name.
Okay, I see. Okay, so they're one and the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would also look at removing calcitonin.
Yeah. I mean, it's approved drug, but I think it's rarely used anymore.
Well, it has limited effectiveness.
Yeah, exactly. And injectable estrogen should be removed.
Are there other clarifications or thoughts about this measure that we should address? I'm assuming we're in agreement about the importance of the measure. Would the recommended modifications, the scientific acceptability of the measure, the feasibility and the usability, it sounds like we're in good shape there. Am I accurate in that assessment?
I have a question about usability.
Usability, go ahead.
Would it fit to more than just physicians and include nurse midwives and other practitioners who diagnose and treat for osteoporosis in using this information and collecting the information under clinicians?
Yeah, this is Sue. This measure, you know, applies to those types of clinicians as well, because the work that they would do would be included in the ICD-9 and CPT code stream.
On page 8, the PA, nurse practitioner, and advanced practice nurse is not checked off.
No, there is nurse midwife included on that list?
Well, the PA usually has the chart co-signed by a physician, so that's the way that's covered.
But for nurse practitioners, some states do not require that oversight.
Right. So for a nurse practitioner...
So this is Heidi. I think they're looking at specifically the check boxes under clinicians. Is that correct on the,
yes,
the form itself?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So we can get the form back to you, because I think you did intend to probably have the measure applicable to physician assistants and nurse practitioners, if I'm understanding you correctly, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So I think we just need to clarify that on the form. I think it's a good point.
I think the other is age. So as we look at the various guidelines that have been provided here, as well as other guidelines, it indicates all adults with fragility fractures, not just those 65 and older. So I think it would be very important to lower that age range. The guidelines that are provided in this measure start at age 40. Some say all adults, both men and women. Men actually with osteoporosis from secondary reasons peak at age 50, and for primary they peak in the 70s. So we are missing the men by only having women in this measure. And then the younger people with low trauma or fragility fractures are also missed.
Well, this is for our Medicare population, isn't that correct? So that would eliminate the younger age patients, but I think including males would be appropriate.
You know, while this was Medicare with the arthritis that we haven't gotten to, they're looking as early as age 21. So we could make that recommendation to be younger.
Yeah, certainly it's within our bounds to, you know, make those suggestions for the CSAC to consider, and certainly for the measure developer to consider as well. I hear a voice in the far distance. I don't know if somebody's trying to speak. No? Okay. Again, looking at the time, not wanting to rush, but still trying to keep us on, get us through our full agenda. Do we have all of the salient points on this particular measure? Any other thoughts?
Yeah, this is Sue. Just a comment in relation to this discussion about age. Certainly something we considered, but, you know, this particular measure applies to the Medicare population because you have a reasonably high volume of fractures there. You're talking about a much smaller volume if you're dealing with, you know, women under 65 or 40 to 65. And so our feeling was that really gets into kind of feasibility and burden issues and really thinking about the balance between those two. So that's one of the reasons we agree. You know, obviously for someone who's, you know, 40 to 65 who's had a fracture, they had treatment. But, you know, again, it's somewhat of a balancing act between feasibility and measure burden. And so I would just ask you to consider that particular aspect of things, you know, in terms of recommending lowering the age.
I am curious about the gender question because I too, when I was reading, was wondering for both measures, really, why men weren't included. And I realize that volume may be lower, but still, I would think the burden on the patient is particularly there. So I don't know if you have a comment to that effect.
Yes. That really, I believe, relates to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations and the other guideline recommendations. Okay. And Safine, feel free to jump in, but my understanding is they're pretty concrete about women and less so about men.
Okay.
I think we need to consider the mortality of men with necrotic-related fractures, especially with hips, can be up to 33% after the first year of fracture.
Okay. So are we ready to move on to the osteoarthritis measures?
Deanne, can we just quickly run through the few things so I make sure that NCQA and staff here know exactly what the requests were?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let me just say what I think I heard and then tell me if I'm wrong. But we'd like NCQA to just go back and look at expanding this to men, potentially looking at a lower age range beyond 65, reviewing the list of allowable therapies. I'm not going to list everything but the ones that were mentioned on the phone. So the only question I have is, was there anything specific to non-traumatic fracture? I may have missed that. Or anything else that we wanted them to clarify?
Yeah, the bone density issue.
Thank you, yes. Good point. Anything else? Okay, I'm going to take that as that's the list.
There you go. Well, thank you to our colleagues from the NCQA for answering our questions and providing some additional information and for their continued work on the in responding to our questions as they go forward. The next measure we have on the list is osteoarthritis functional and pain assessment. And who did anyone who's on the call have that to vet ahead of time, or does someone want to take first crack? It doesn't look like it. So, well, I'll just open the floor. Are there comments or questions? We do have PCPI representatives here. Suddenly very quiet. Did I lose you all?
I think it was pretty straightforward.
Okay. Any remembering that the principal question that Heidi posed to us is anything in the evidence base that we know of now that is different or that might impact this measure's specification that we should be aware of or that the CSAC should be aware of? I take that to be a no.
So we can, unless there's something, we can just say that this measure would go forward as a recommended to continue endorsement?
Yep.
Unless there's something? Okay.
That would be fine with me. I'm just looking back at the public commentary. Just to see if there's anything there that, that we might have wanted to talk about. And really, the two comments were, one was an issue of current compliance, and the response was provided about the PQRI compliance versus other compliance and the variability there. So it seemed sufficient to me. I don't know if the PCPI representatives want to address that or not, but it looked reasonable to me. And then the other question was about whether or not assessment leads to appropriate treatment, which I think is a question we have about all process measures, is whether testing really leads, or providing something really leads to an impact on outcome. So I didn't have any particular issues there. So are we good to move it forward?
I would think so.
Okay. Very good. All right. And then the last measure was the osteoarthritis measure, prescription management, if I remember correctly. Assessment for use of anti-inflammatory or analgesic over-the-counter medications. Any concerns, thoughts, other evidence we should be aware of?
I guess, to me, the question is what is the importance at this point? Because anti-inflammatories are sold over-the-counter. We know that anti-inflammatories have been responsible for causing ulcers, and most clinicians use analgesics at this point. Do we need this measure?
And I don't know if folks from the PCPI want to answer that question. I don't know. Do we know? I mean, do we have evidence to answer that question at this point?
Hi, this is Carrie from the PCPI. I think if I can, I wasn't around when the measure was first developed, but I do know that the thought process was that they wanted the clinician to assess whether or not the patient was already using these medications before making any treatment modifications. So that asking the question of, are you already using any of these, could help a clinician then tailor the treatment to the patient. So it was kind of one of those, you need to ask the questions before you can make any changes.
And how is this being done? Is this by physician record review or?
Yes. And then it's also being used in PQRI. It was used in PQRI last year, but we don't have the data yet.
Okay.
Well, from a burden of providing the data standpoint, I would guess it's a simple checkbox, yes or no, you did or you didn't, and you fill out the appropriate code to reflect that. So if it's not a burdensome thing to keep doing, and I'm asking, I don't know, but if, assuming it's not a burdensome thing, I would guess it's reasonable to keep in the mix until we have data to really take a look at it. Because I had noticed the same thing, that, you know, what we really need is the information from the PQRI data to help us know about importance and gaps and those kinds of things. And we just don't have that at this point in time.
Right, and I can, when we're done here, I can go double back and check, and if we can get it, I can provide it as well.
Okay.
That would be great.
Any other thoughts about this measure? Heidi, are we good?
I think so. We'll just wait to hear back from PCPI on this and then circle back with all of you if they do indeed have the data.
Okay. Well, at this point in time, then I think if we're concluded with the discussion about the maintenance review, then this is the opportunity for NQF member or public comment. So, Heidi, I don't know if you want to facilitate that.
Sure. And I think I don't know if anyone is on it, one of the public lines and needs to be put in, or is everyone in the speaker line? Can the operator tell us that?
And I don't know how to get in touch with the operator.
Yeah, they should be on, but I think we had several individuals from the public who were already on the line, so I'll just open it up to see if anyone has any comments or anything to add.
Okay.
Hi, this is John Shaw from Next Wave in Albany. Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you, John. Go ahead.
Oh, apparently the lines are open. Okay. We're members of NQF on the QMRI Council, and one of the areas that drove our interest here is looking at some of the national priorities that came out of the partnership, and particularly many of the specific target areas in the management of overuse are related to the orthopedic area in terms of imaging, medical versus surgical treatment in spine, and surgery for hip and knee. And I heard some comments throughout today expressing some interest peripherally, but I guess our concern looking towards the future is implementation of health reform, particularly those aspects that are looking to try to address and assess reform activities and waste. And I guess the two areas that have been discussed over time and possible measures are looking at potentially preventable admissions, and that might be particularly in the spine area, as well as readmissions, where there's a lot of discussion that it will be implemented, but I'm not so sure that we have validated measures in orthopedics as yet to actually do so. And particularly some of the concerns were raised in earlier discussions for attribution. If someone who had their hip replaced comes back on a readmission, why might that be? Is it the hospital? Is it the surgeon? Is it the home care agency? Is it the rehab agency, et cetera? So those are issues that will probably have to be addressed in order to implement some of the priorities that are in the reform package. And another thing that was mentioned and some questions about is the patient experience of care. And on that side, there are a couple new measures that could be applicable in the CAPS surveys. There's the CAPS Surgical Care Survey that's looking at a number of items before surgery, during surgery, and after surgery, which particularly address coordination of care, as well as a list of questions dealing with health literacy to try to get some handle on the appropriate communication with the patient and their family, which is yet another area of the priorities. So I think those are areas that we had seen in the future having not only a need for measures, but probably a near-term need for measures. And what might be available to analyze there? Have there been evaluations of the premier experiment that has hip and knee readmissions in it and so on, to look at appropriate issues of attribution and risk adjustment, including the coordination and communication with the patient and their family.
Very good. Thank you.
This is Silvina Levis. I have to get off the phone right now, so I want to say goodbye and thank you.
Thank you, Silvina, for your work and your input, and we'll be coming back around with you via email.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Are there any other public comments that are out there waiting in the wings?
This is Janice Yazdani. Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you.
Okay. I'm from the American College of Rheumatology. I'm a rheumatologist at UCSF. And I just wanted to get back to the gaps, especially in rheumatoid arthritis, and maybe provide our perspective
on that
particular area. I think the most important gap in rheumatoid arthritis is controlling disease activity, in terms of a measure that assesses the control of disease activity. And probably the largest barrier to developing such a measure is the lack of a uniformly accepted measure of disease activity. Currently, most doctors don't actually routinely measure disease activity in a standardized fashion. And by standardized fashion, I mean using one of the widely accepted composite measures that include things like joint counts, inflammatory markers, or global assessments. In Europe, where a measure called the DAS is routinely used, there have been outcome measures developed that actually look at how quickly patients get to a certain DAS score, but we're not quite there in the United States. But what I can tell you in terms of what our college is doing is sort of laying the foundation and doing some preliminary work so that we can eventually move in that direction. Currently, we have a measure that is looking at physicians assessing disease activity on a routine basis, and we're testing that measure in our national registry that was recently launched. So I think, you know, the groundwork will be laid, so we're just not quite there yet in terms of, you know, the testing of such a measure. So anyway, that's sort of the main thing that I wanted to let you all know about.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Heidi, if I could just ask if the operator texts the the audience line?
Sure.
Operator?
All lines are open. Everyone.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, if there are no further comments, Heidi, I think you have the wrap-up.
Yes, just to let everyone know what next steps will be, we're going to type up notes and develop a summary of our discussion, particularly with the gaps piece, and then we will reach out and work with the measure developers, NCQA and PCPI, to get the additional information, circle back with all of you by email, I think, make sure that you're comfortable and what your final recommendation is on the measures, and then we will let you know when it goes to the CSAC. So that will be next steps.
Very good. Any questions from the panel members about any of the process we're going through?
Will there be a summary from the steering committee eventually?
Yes, there will.
About the gaps?
Yes.
Okay.
And that will be shared with all of you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
To what extent can we share information with the organizations that we represent based on this call that we've had?
This is a public call, so you are welcome to share whatever you choose. We'll also be posting the meeting summary at some point to the website as well.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right. Well, I appreciate everybody taking the time out of their busy schedules to be here for a couple of hours and for your contributions both in preparation for the call, on the call, and in the follow-up that will ensue. And thank you again to the measure developers for being prepared to respond to our questions and for some continued work, and to the additional members who provided some great insights and thoughts for us to pursue. So with that, I think we'll close the call. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.